We're very excited to have Michael Rupert on the line. He's the author of Crossing the Rubicon, The Decline of the American Empire at the End of the Age of Oil, which was published in September 2004, and I'm proud to say it was published right here in Nanaimo with New Society Publishers on Gabriola Island. And he's also the publisher and editor of From the Wilderness. Hello, Michael.
Hi, it's good to be with you.
Fantastic.
Thank you very much.
So perhaps you could just give us a little summary of your background and how you got interested in 9/11 and all these other issues you discuss in your book.
Well, the path really started a long, long time ago, way back in the 1970s. I had the misfortune, I guess I would say now, of having been born into a family that was deeply rooted in the U.S. intelligence community. My mother had been a cryptanalyst for the U.S. Secretary of State Cordell Hull during World War II. Dad left the Air Force as an aviator and went to work for Martin Marietta on projects for the CIA. And all of Dad's relatives were like from CIA. And I used to come home from school and say, "What's for dinner?" And Mom would say, "I can't tell you." Having had that background, I had a Q clearance because I lived in the same house with my parents as a teenager. And when I started interning for LAPD as a freshman at UCLA, they ran my clearance and said, "Oh, who's this guy?" And I wound up interning immediately for the chief of police, pretty close. And I became a policeman, and during the course of that time, the CIA tried to recruit me, and I discovered in 1976-77 that the agency was very deeply involved in smuggling heroin into the country. That was the forerunner of the cocaine of the 1980s, same group of people. And I tried to blow the whistle on it. I basically refused to get involved, and that wound up costing me my career. I wasn't fired. I was about to be promoted, had great rating reports, but people were shooting at me, and I asked for help, and the police department wasn't going to give me any. So that kind of changed my worldview, and that started me on a path which has evolved over the years to begin publishing my newsletter now more than 8 years ago. And I was already publishing when 9/11 happened. So, and having written about covert operations for then 10, 15 years, I was in a position to jump right into 9/11 and start looking at the anomalies of the event, and there were many, and that led ultimately to Rubicon.
Maybe we should start then about what we were wondering. What is the, you know, the chicken and the egg situation? Is it peak oil or is it 9/11? Where is the best place to begin? But I'd really like to talk about some of the stuff that you have discovered about 9/11, the war games and the jets that didn't scramble.
Was there a key thing about 9/11 that particularly started you being very interested in it?
Oh, on the day of the attacks, as the second plane hit the World Trade Center. Having been an Air Force brat, my father flew in interceptors, and I was raised around that culture, and I knew NORAD air defense procedures, and I knew immediately that when the second airliner hit the tower, something absolutely extraneous and irregular had to have intervened to allow that second plane to hit, because the system was foolproof. It had worked perfectly for decades. And there's no way that the second plane could have hit unless somebody wanted it to. So, you know, from day one, I was on the case.
Because jets, the Air Force should have had fighter jets up there escorting that second one?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was a very airtight system. It had been in place since the 50s. My dad had been stationed in Maine waiting, you know, for the Russian bombers to come over the pole in the early 50s. And plenty of fighters around normally, and that's ultimately what I wound up, you know, kind of closing the book with, was the systematic way in which the vice president, actually, and we have documented this, who had been placed in charge of all war game training or exercises months before 9/11, his office had scheduled 5 or 6, now possibly 7, overlapping war game exercises, which moved most of the fighters out of the region and had injected as many as 22 false radar blips onto radar screens.
On that day?
During the attacks, yes. And
what are the chances of that happening?
Absolutely.
That's
astronomical.
Very, very strange coincidence.
Yeah, and I also was able to get a written on-the-record confirmation from a U.S. Air Force major from NORAD that, in fact, the U.S. government was also flying an airplane posing as a hijacked airliner at the same time the attacks were taking place.
And
of course, we heard none of that in the 9/11 Commission report from the Kane Commission.
No, and we've heard nothing on the in the media except the official story. And even people that I think should be questioning this a little more are just going along with the official story that it was a terrorist attack. And that
even in a lot of the alternative press, it's kind of taken as a given that it was Osama bin Laden. And
so now you think that Dick Cheney is at the top of all of this?
Absolutely. And I name him in the book and list him as my prime suspect. Having worked LAPD, not only in uniform, I also worked assignments in detectives, homicide and burglary, but I also worked narcotics, so I know how to build cases. And in a murder case, you have to look for means, motive, and opportunity. And, of course, the motive ultimately turned out to be peak oil. But I have a case in Crossing the Rubicon that I would take to a jury right now, assuming that there was such a thing as an honest court with the real will to pursue this. I would take the book right now and use that as a case to prosecute.
Wow.
And so you look at who stands to benefit the most from this happening?
Obviously this was a horrendous crime. And, the first hurdles that people have to overcome is their belief that the U.S. government would never possibly do anything like this, when in fact that there's proof that they have done stuff like this. In the back of the book, we republished documents from Operation North Woods in 1962 that were declassified top secret Pentagon documents. And these documents, signed by General Lemnitzer, who was chairman of the Joint Chiefs at the time, called for the shooting down of U.S. airplanes, attacks on U.S. bases, and blaming that on Fidel Castro for the purpose of starting a war with Cuba. And that plan is all declassified. And we also know now that before Pearl Harbor, the U.S. government had broken the Japanese codes, knew the attacks were coming, and Franklin Roosevelt allowed the attacks to happen to get us into World War II. Now, 9/11 is an evolution beyond that, because we show that there was direct U.S. participation and intervention during the attacks to make sure they succeeded.
Is it your belief that the simulations that mm-hmm. were happening on September the 11th, and now that there was one a simulation of a commercial airliner flying into a big building, right? One of the war games was.
That was a separate exercise that I kind of put in a class by itself. It was actually held by the National Reconnaissance Office outside of Washington, D.C. That had there was a drill going on the same morning that called for an airliner crashing into a building. But that's completely separate from the military exercises, which had moved the fighters around out of the country to Alaska, northern Canada, Iceland, and Greenland. Which were active roles. There's a distinction between what they call a tabletop exercise or command post exercise, where there's no actual flying of planes or, you know, people moving around. It's just tabletop or computer simulation. That's what the injects were. Then there's a field training exercise, which is where you get into the live fly of aircraft and things like that. Both were taking place.
Now, is it your belief that the war games, the information, the classified information, was leaked to the terrorists, or are these not terrorists at all? They're just working for the government, for Dick Cheney.
Some of them were terrorists, and this is where it helps if one has a little background in covert operations. In the history of intelligence and covert operations, the best kind of assets are the ones who don't know who's pulling their strings.
Hmm.
So on the day of 9/11, the so-called muscle hijackers probably were and believed they were dedicated hijackers.
The ones that actually died.
Well, yeah. But you had a separate cadre of people, and we established from Newsweek and other sources in the book that as many as five had received training at U.S. military facilities. That includes Mohammed Atta, al-Shihi, and others who had actually trained at military bases. That's a different cast of characters. And I, for one, am not convinced that some of those people were actually on the aircraft that day. And in fact, we have Newsweek, New York Times, BBC, a whole host of sources that came out within a year after the attacks that showed as many as seven of the so-called hijackers were still alive.
Yeah, I heard about
that.
I heard one of the guys was saying that he read himself in a magazine that he had died in the attacks, and he was saying, "What? I'm still alive. What's going on?"
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. So one of the big questions I think that people often throw out in discussions, you know, coffee shop conversations about this type of thing is, how could there, if it is a conspiracy, how could there be such a big conspiracy? How could, you know, it would have to have thousands of people involved, and how could everyone keep the secrets? And mm-hmm. what sort of answer do you have to that?
Well, first of all, that's a total red herring because that's an incorrect assumption. If you look back historically, the United States was able to keep secret the Manhattan Project, which developed the atomic bomb, and the Stealth Fighter Project and many other classified programs. They were able to do that quite successfully. Mm. That's because of what's called compartmentalization. But for an event like 9/11 to have taken place or been executed, you didn't need thousands of people to know. You needed very key people in very key places at the Secret Service, at NORAD, at the Pentagon, at Cheyenne Mountain in Colorado, at Tyndall Air Force Base in Washington, D.C., and in New York. A few, you know, people there, but we're not talking thousands now. We're down to tens of people who would have had to know their specific role, not necessarily the whole plan. Hmm. And they would have been career people who had signed secrecy oaths, who were bound, who would, you know, follow orders, who had already demonstrated the will to do something like this. The rest of the people involved, all they had to do was do what they were supposed to do. Their normal jobs.
I want to jump in here and let people know, remind people if they have been listening, that we're speaking with editor and author Michael Rupert, writer of Crossing the Rubicon, and also a publisher and editor of From the Wilderness, an investigative reporter. How much do you think the president is involved in this, or what does he know? Is he? I always kind of think of him as a bit of a dupe, a guy that they just kind of put up there. They give him some things to say, but that Cheney is kind of the guy behind. What's your take on that?
Well, there's no question that that's the way I write in the book, and that's what the evidence shows. I would tend to give George W. Bush credit for being a little smarter than most people want to think he is. It's easy to dismiss evil if you can chalk it up to stupidity or error. But there's no question in my mind that Dick Cheney is the hands-on operational manager. He's the guy with the brains, the organizational skill, et cetera, to have executed. And in the book, we placed Dick Cheney. There was a famous little snip where he was allegedly rushed out of the Oval Office down to the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, which is a bunker way deep below the White House. And I think that was a rush to get him down to a place where he could control everything. And in the book, through using government records, we showed clearly that the PEOC in the basement has communications, command, control, and communications capable of overriding everything in the government, all in the hands of the Secret Service. And by law in the U.S., the Secret Service in emergencies overrides every part of the U.S. government, and that includes the military.
Really?
Yes.
Whoa.
And so, for example, you have a case where the Air Force wasn't deployed to, for example, stop the second plane, which is one thing that people point to as being sort of weird. And what you would have to have is that the government Air Force wasn't necessarily all in on it. They simply were confused by different radars or something like that, or confused by the information coming in.
Well, it was a combination. They had scheduled war games like Northern Vigilance and Northern Guardian and others that I name in the book, which were planned in advance, scheduled to be simulations of intercepting Russian bombers coming over the pole. I mean, you know, the Soviet Union went away some time ago. This is not an immediate threat. And yet, at a time of heightened alert, heightened security, with all these written warnings that planes were going to be hijacked and crashed into the World Trade Center, I mean, dozens of warnings. Why, then, were the fighters from the Northeast Air Defense Sector moved to Alaska, northern Canada, up in the territories, the Yukon, Iceland, and Greenland? That just took the fighters out of the picture completely. And we haven't come up with an exact number that's still classified, but I figured that there were maybe only 8 fighters available that day, and they have to be scrambled in pairs. Now, if you have 22 radar blips that may be hijacks, and you can't tell the real ones from the injects, that's what they're called, you can't send your fighters because you don't risk sending them to the wrong blip.
Mm. Wow.
So they were paralyzed.
We want to get to the motive in just a second, but I have another question that I want you to give us your thoughts on. 3 buildings came down at the World Trade Center that day. The two big towers that we all think of as the World Trade Center. And then WTC is at 7. This one came down hours after the fact. And I've seen footage that shows that the steel girders that that make up the frame of the building all were blown into the exact same size chunks. They're all just long enough to be trucked away on a truck. The claim is that it was the heat from the fire that melted the girders. When you look at the girders, you know they're not melted. What are your thoughts on this from your investigations?
Well, that's absolutely correct. I, for one, do not believe that the buildings were brought down as a result of the crashes alone. However, having been in court, I see a real trap here. First of all, if you're going to take a case like this to court, and that's all I care about, I don't care about public opinion, I want to put criminals in jail. And if you take a case like this to court, you have several problems. First of all the evidence has been destroyed. It was destroyed and trucked away immediately after the attack, so you've lost your physical proof. Secondly, once you get into arguments of engineering and so forth, you have to rely on, in a criminal court, expert testimony. Now, those of us who would like for 9/11 to be opened could afford maybe one or two PhDs. The question is, in a jury trial, how many PhDs could the U.S. government provide?
Right.
And as you go before the jury, then what you wind up with is a case of dueling experts where eyes glaze and minds numb. And you miss the chance for a real conviction. That's why I, in Rubicon, I took the very studious track of saying, I don't need scientific evidence here. I can prove my case strictly on a written record or a record of statements using official documents, undisputed stuff, and I can prove the murder case that way, and you don't need a scientist to intervene.
So another question that a lot of people ask is, okay, so if this did happen, why would the U.S. government do this to their own people? What would be the motive behind doing something like that? I mean, such a big operation and so much resources. Why would they go to all the trouble?
That's the big question. And now you come in addressing the issues of means, motive, and opportunity. Here you've arrived at motive. What possible motive could have justified such a horrendous crime? And it was very quickly after 9/11 that I was contacted by a geologist, Dale Allen Pfeiffer, who wrote some of our most amazing stories. By the way, I should name our website. It's fromthewilderness.com. You can see an enormous amount of background material there. Most of it's free on what we've done. And so as I looked at this, I was contacted. You know, you got to look at this Peak Oil thing, which was basically an argument or a postulate that, hey, planet Earth is beginning to run out of hydrocarbon energy. They know this. They've known this for some time, and I was able to show that very early on in the book, that Dick Cheney knew about Peak Oil back in 99. That is the biggest single human, biggest single event in human history. We are a hydrocarbon energy-based civilization. 6.5 billion people on the planet today. 4 billion people came into existence when we started using petroleum. The world population was stable at 2 billion for about 2,000 years.
Wow.
So as the as the oil goes away, what we started was, and I'll never forget, on the day of 9/11, seeing Dick Cheney saying, this is a war that will go around the world, wherever we have to go, and it is a world that will not end in our lifetimes. And what I construct in the book, and I was writing in late 2001, was that what we're witnessing now is a sequential war to control the last remaining oil reserves on the planet. And, of course, that's exactly the way it has played out since.
It's almost like he was reading directly from George Orwell's 1984. That's what they have there. They have the perpetual war.
Well, this is more than that, because in 1984, they didn't have energy shortages. You know, there was poverty and everything else. But there are 10 calories of hydrocarbon energy in every calorie of food consumed on the planet.
Wow.
If you take away the hydrocarbon energy, people starve. And human civilization is not possible without oil, natural gas, and coal. Now, this is not saying that the world's going to have oil and natural gas on Sunday and wake up on Monday morning and it's gone. That's not the point. The point is that in a bell-shaped curve, once you reach the peak and you start the downslope, you've already picked the low-hanging fruit. You've picked the light sweet crude, the big fields. Now as you go down, every drop of oil gets more expensive, harder to get, and it's of inferior quality. And you will never be able to increase production, even as demand is soaring.
Right.
There's a 96% correlation between economic growth or GDP growth and greenhouse gas emission. And there are no substitutes for hydrocarbon energy. None.
And so why did they need a 9/11 to deal with the problem of peak oil?
Well, if we're going to go out and surround the Middle East, which is what we've done, occupy Iraq, cut Russia off from the Middle East, which we did by occupying Afghanistan, more or less, surrounding Iran, that 60% of all the recoverable oil on the planet's in the Persian Gulf. So we have surrounded the Persian Gulf, heavy military deployment in Saudi Arabia. We've occupied Iraq, and we've really botched that up. But that's exactly what played out after that. And the American people would never have supported that kind of an imperial acquisition by force of resources without 9/11.
Mm-hmm. And you can see it surfacing anytime the public gets a little queasy about the war. 9/11 comes up, and George Bush, every time he makes a speech now, he mentions 9/11 and the terrorist attacks and the you know, the we got to, you know, do this and fight back. And yeah, one thing I wonder is there are, you know, we hear about alternatives to oil, about biodiesel and things like that. What is the there seems to be this almost like this gold fever with oil that the powers that be are going after. Why not put our resources and our brains to work on finding something that can replace oil? You know,
there is nothing that will replace oil. That's one of the great fallacies. Technology is not energy. All technology requires energy to operate. That doesn't mean that technology is energy. I'm going to lock the best scientists in the world up with a bank in a bank vault with all the money in the world and all the time. They will not be able to materialize a hot dog without a pig.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
tofu dog.
True. I understand that a lot of, especially hydrogen cells, you know, they only store energy, for instance. Yeah.
Well, hydrogen is a chimera, and it's an insult. It is a joke. It's going to be used as a handout to major corporations. Hydrogen is one proton and one electron, and in its gaseous state, according to a UC study from a couple of years ago, 3 years ago, it takes 1,113 gallons of gaseous hydrogen to give you the same energy in 1 gallon of gasoline.
Yeah.
Now, EV Magazine, electric vehicle magazine, you know, had a study come out about a year ago showing that the average life expectancy of a fuel cell motor is 200 hours. How would you like to change the engine in your car every 200 hours?
Yeah, I've never changed the engine in my car, so no kidding.
There you go.
Just before we get to going beyond peak oil, I was just wondering, there's also been some other discussion within alternative media and that talking about peak oil and saying that they don't believe in peak oil because they think that it's just a scam to drive up oil prices.
Mm-hmm.
What response do you have to that?
There are a bunch of shills for the U.S. government and Wall Street designed to keep American consumers greedily consuming resources at a fast rate because our economy is based upon infinite growth, which is absolutely impossible if you think about it. All of those arguments fall flat on their face. I mean, it is hard to argue that Wall Street and corporations are benefiting when GM is just about to go out of business. When airlines, three major airlines, have filed bankruptcy within the last year, when fuel prices are, you know, soaring to it's 70 a barrel, and I've just seen projections that we'll have $6 and $7 gasoline this summer. It's hard to see how business benefits from that, and you know, the science just doesn't support an argument like that at all. But it's a very convenient way out for people who aren't psychologically, spiritually, or emotionally prepared to deal with the challenges.
I've also heard that in Iraq, a lot of people will make the argument that, oh, well, it was a big mistake and it was a big failure because, you know, it's all sliding into chaos. But it's sort of a managed chaos the way I see it. And do you think it's possible that, for example, all the money that's been spent on the Iraq war and all of the debt that's being accumulated, it's being accumulated because perhaps money in the future is not going to be of great importance? It's going to be more about resources, like physical resources?
That's a great question. basically, money is going to behave completely differently, and it's inevitable that the U.S. economy is going to be intentionally tanked, even by the people running the economy, because most of the richest people in this country have their money offshore already. The U.S. is full of consumers who are saturated with debt. Highest debt levels in history, highest bank level of bankruptcy filings in history. We can't borrow any money. American consumption is now based upon borrowing $2 billion a day from overseas. And it's clear that as the dollar gets weaker and oil gets scarcer and prices go up, the American people won't be able to pay them let's call it the minimum monthly payment on their debt. And we will see major assets in the U.S. sold off like in a fire sale. A colleague of mine, dear friend Catherine Austin Fitz, a former assistant secretary of housing and a past managing director at Dillon Reed, the investment bank, describes it very, very clearly. They make money on the way up and they make money on the way down, and have not a whit of care for the well-being of consumers. So that's what's coming.
Hmm. Hasn't the United States government just increased the amount that they can go into debt? Just increased it to $9 trillion or some unimaginable amount of money?
And also at the same time that the Federal Reserve has stopped publishing data on the M3 money supply, which is basically all the cash in circulation, not only just paper cash, but paper deposits, money market funds, the ways that dollars are created, and that's to hide the fact that inflation is really starting to take a major bite here. So they all know this is coming. It's very clear that they know this is coming. We've on the website at FromTheWilderness.com, we've even just published a series of stories showing how the U.S. military is very aware of peak oil. The largest consumer of renewable energy in the entire U.S. Is the Air Force. They all know it's coming.
Mm-hmm. George Bush himself lives in a house with renewable energy and solar panels.
So does Al Gore.
Now, you have some solutions in mind, I believe, for...
Yeah, this is something I find particularly interesting, and I think is interesting for our listeners as well. We have a lot of listeners that live on Gulf Islands and that are living at least semi-sustainable or very sustainable lifestyles. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of possibility for that, especially in this particular part of the world. And there's a lot of people around here that are interested in and aware of what you're talking about and are interested in moving on and getting out of the electricity grid, for example. So perhaps you could talk a little bit about that. I saw on your website that you have local peak oil preparedness events going on. And so how would you say that people begin preparing themselves for the upcoming possibility of peak oil?
Well, of course, the most important thing is to read and study and learn about what peak oil and natural gas is actually going to mean. Mm-hmm. So you understand what you're going to be looking at in terms of your economic energy challenges and otherwise. And we have more original reporting on peak oil on our website at FromTheWilderness.com than any other site on the web. And the first thing people need to understand is that neither government nor corporations is going to lift a finger to help them, period. The only way that those who are able will be able to survive the challenges of peak oil, and I for one believe that peak oil is here now, today. Kenneth DeFays of Princeton put the data as December 16, 2005. We're certainly seeing all the signs that it's here. So there is no time to wait. It takes 30 years to change an energy infrastructure, but in the meantime, it's like Katrina and Rita in the hurricanes in the Gulf, where everything breaks down, and you can't expect the system to function normally as the system is breaking down. So the way people are going to survive is by relocalizing. Globalization is dead. As oil prices continue to rise, it's not going to be feasible to drive a head of lettuce from California to New York for a Caesar salad or to fly strawberries from Chile to Los Angeles. So food production will revert to local. And I've just relocated my company to Southern Oregon because there's a huge area of sustainability and lots of knowledge here. There is in Northern California, but all throughout the Pacific Northwest, even all the way up there.
Mm-hmm.
So people need to, those who are able, 6.5 billion people can't move to the land. The numbers just don't work, obviously. But for those who can, you need to get to arable land, access to fresh water, lumber, and low population density. That's the start. And these kind of moves are taking place all over. But even within that, I've seen throughout the Pacific Northwest, and we're starting to cover a lot more of that now. I have a writer now down in Willits, California, covering a three-day sustainability event down there, where skills, everything from seed saving, seed swapping, permaculture, biodiesel making, lots of trades and crafts are all emerging into these local, regional, very important networks of people that can take care of themselves. And that's what you have to, that's the direction we all have to move. Unfortunately, the people in the big cities have a harder problem, and there's a huge battle. That's very important. Let me talk about this for a sec.
Mm-hmm.
In South Central Los Angeles, there's a place called the South Central Farm, and we've covered it very intensively. 14 acres that used to be like in the middle of South Central was reclaimed about 13, 14 years ago. Those 14 acres are now feeding 350 families.
Wow.
In the inner city of Los Angeles. And the city and the owner are trying to tear down the farm to build a warehouse for Walmart. And
oh,
so we're seeing
God.
A major point of resistance evolving over the South Central Farm because people in the cities need help as much as everybody else.
Mm-hmm. And so do you think that it's going to happen in like one fell swoop, like a one big crash? Or
no.
Is it going to be sort of swift but sort of gradual, so to say?
It is going to be incremental, although there are serious risks of anything setting off major collapses. For example, a nuclear war over Iranian oil kind of like is King's X on the whole thing, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But we will see, we have already seen national casualties as a result of peak oil. Indonesia, which was a founding member of OPEC, is now in serious decline. As a matter of fact, something like 33 of the world's 35 largest producing nations are all in decline, meaning every year they're producing less and less oil, and that curve is getting steeper. And Indonesia has had to remove subsidies. They're now importing oil. There's 160%+ increase in the price of kerosene in one day last summer. Their economy is falling apart. Zimbabwe is also under as a result of peak oil. So the casualties are starting to mount, and they'll fall like dominoes. The key is, I guess, when you get to the, if we're playing musical chairs, the key is when you start threatening the G8 nations.
Mm.
And China, of course. China is the ultimate endgame.
Countries like China, I find it strange that they could not know about peak oil, but how are they expecting then to have, they're sort of shifting their economies to be more and more dependent on oil, are they not? And India as well. How do they expect to be able to survive if it is going to be a dwindling resource in the future?
Well, you see, that's the trap. There's no place else to go.
Hmm.
And the current global financial paradigm, based on fiat currency, since the dollar is presently the reserve currency of the world,
mm-hmm.
based upon debt-based financing and fractional reserve banking, and the way the current paradigm works is if you don't grow, it's a pyramid scheme, you collapse. So you're trapped. China's economy has been growing at 8, 9, 10% a year. Their oil consumption is, you know, they're now the second largest importer of oil in the world, but they have no way out. If they stop importing oil and natural gas, their economy collapses and they have a revolution at home.
So there's no practical way for a country like China to get into renewables at this point. It's just too late.
Well, let me put it this way. If you were in a race competing with the other large industrial giant nations of the world, and your car, that's a great metaphor, ran faster on oil, would you voluntarily switch to a slower car when the race wasn't over?
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't.
Right.
That's the trap.
I see. Just to sort of go in a completely, somewhat different direction, there's a new film coming out that you are being featured in, and I saw the trailer for it, and it looks really amazing. It's called America from Freedom to Fascism, and I think it also deeply relates to Canada because of our current government. We have a conservative government that is committed to following the U.S. administration in whatever it is doing. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about that and when it's coming out, that sort of stuff.
The film was produced and directed by Aaron Russo, who is a very accomplished Hollywood producer-director who did Trading Places with Eddie Murphy. He did The Rose with Bette Midler, Wise Guys. He actually managed Led Zeppelin, brought Led Zeppelin to the States. He's been around a long time, very accomplished guy, has Boku Oscar nominations and Grammys and Tonys and all that stuff. And he took a subject which has to do with the IRS and the tax code in the U.S. and the fact that the 16th Amendment to the Constitution, our Constitution, was never ratified. And then he takes it further to show that there is not a single statute anywhere in the IRS code that requires an American citizen to pay taxes on their income. And so he has a number of really good people. I'm just one of many in the film, but Catherine Austin Fitz, Congressman Ron Paul is in it. Sherry Jackson, a really good friend, former IRS agent, is in it. There's a lot of great people in the film. And he ties the tax and monetary system, and he takes on the Federal Reserve, which is a privately owned bank, to what has happened in the country since 9/11 in terms of the loss of our civil liberties. It's really quite a moving film, and it's been blowing people out in sneak previews all over the U.S. I don't have exact details on it, but I believe Aaron's going to have a theatrical release in New York sometime around July the 4th, but I haven't seen a firm announcement on that yet.
Yeah, and on the website, I think they said it's going to be released at Cannes in May.
It's been entered into the Cannes Film Festival.
Right.
And of course, Aaron will get to go over there and have a lot of fun in Cannes. wish I could go. But that's just, I mean, it's probably going to get an Oscar nomination, too. I people just rave about the film. It is mind-blowing.
Yeah, just the trailer that I saw was quite mind-blowing, just the kind of stuff that people are saying. And, of course, we had a guest on Elephant Talk here, and he talked about the same thing in Canada. There is no law, actually, that requires Canadians to pay taxes. It was never given royal assent by the Queen, the law that they tried to draft. It's quite interesting. The film is a lot about IRS fraud, and also there's a mention of the microchipping of people as well, the chipping of people so that they can be tracked and things like that.
And I wrote about that in Crossing the Rubicon probably 2 years before the movie was done. So, yeah, no, that's very much on the agenda.
The film, I must say, sounds just amazing. We watched the trailer last night and really look forward to seeing that. We are, however, pretty much out of time. I'd like to thank you, Michael, for joining us today. It's been a great honor.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure on my end because you guys asked really great questions, and nothing makes me happier than to hear really great questions asked.
And I'd like to encourage people to check out your excellent website, and that's fromthewilderness.com. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and thanks for choosing one of our local publishers, New Society Press, on Gabriel Island. It's nice to see such a popular book being made locally.
We kind of chose each other, and I say hi to everybody at New Society.
Right on.
Great.
All right. Well, we thank you again, sir, and keep up the very important work. That's Michael Rupert we're speaking to there, and we hope to see you out here at some point in the near future.